Hello, just a quick bit before this week's episode to let you know that we have a Patreon you can subscribe to if you like what we're doing here and you want more of it. You probably already knew that. We don't stop going on about it. What you didn't know is that you can currently get a little free trial, so you know exactly what you'd get as part of your subscription. You can head to patreon.com/whatismusicpod or follow the link in the show notes to get your first 7 days free. All you need to do is pick which tier you'd like a free trial of. The Biggest Mates tier is the one that has all the extras in it. And then for 7 days, you are free to listen to any episode we've released in the last 6 months. You can cancel any time or just leave the subscription rolling if you like what you find. It's charged monthly. And during any month, as part of that Biggest Mates tier, you'll get ad-free episodes of this show every Monday. You'll get a brand new episode of our new Manic Street Preacher show every month. 2 episodes every month of the Ultimate Playlist, our themed playlist show, where we talk about all kinds of different music, different artists, different genres, different eras, and 1 or 2 bonus episodes every month, depending on the length of the month. That's 2 episodes every week. There's also other tiers to trial. One that is just the Manic Show and ad-free What Is Music episodes, and another that is just ad-free What Is Music episodes. But hey, if the first 7 days are free, why not try a bit of everything? Plus, all tiers include access to the exclusive subscriber-only Discord where we discuss the shows, the bands we've covered, various music topics, and loads of other stuff, including some games that the friendly community have devised themselves. So head on over to our Patreon page now to claim your free 7-day trial. Go to patreon.com/whatismusicpod or follow the link in our show notes. See you there.
I know. Have you heard, guys? Have you heard of the band Radiohead?
Hi, Joe.
Hey, man.
Hello, fellas.
Hey, man. How's it going? Hello.
Oh my God, you've got such a nice microphone.
Ah, thank you.
Yeah. That's the
But I don't think you're coming through it.
Is it not coming through to you guys?
You might Hold be. On. Well, either it's a really nice looking microphone that sounds like shit, right? Or or you're coming through the computer, like webcam, Let's whatever see. Thingy.
On Zoom, you can like choose which
one. Yeah, I've got, it looks like, oh yeah, it's coming through the web. Okay.
Wait for it. Oh my God, the change.
It's so Chris. Much better.
There you go.
Coming up for air.
Are you all
That's such a good microphone.
unless I'm very much mistaken, we just watched The King of Limbs live from the basement. Is that not the same microphone that Tom uses?
It is, in fact, the Electro Voice RE20. I go too hardcore, you know. I gotta get all the reference points right.
Love that shit. We're gonna talk about all sorts of stuff like that. Hello, welcome to What Is Music, a music podcast about music. We're a podcast that focuses on discographies in their entirety, doing deep dives on one artist at a time. You join us in season 4, which is called "Is It Rad in Yo Head?" A critical analysis of the history, cultural impact, and music of Radiohead. We're going through their entire career, album by album, track by track, asking questions like, does context matter when you're listening to music? Does knowing the history of an artist affect your appreciation of their output? And this season we are, of course, asking, is it rad in your head? And to be clear, we're asking, is it rad in your head in regards to the band Radiohead, not is it rad in your head in regards to this, the 4th season of our podcast, which is called Is It Rad in Your Head, and which is now in your head. I'm Adam Scott Glasspool. I'm obsessed with music. I love the artistry, the emotion, and also the context that surrounds music. With me, as always, is someone who has said that they do not care about art or talking about art and doesn't often relate personally to music in any way and is obsessed with Stardew Valley. It's Lucas Way.
I fucking hate music.
In the middle of that, we have someone who can appreciate context, art, and subject matter and is just learning how to convey that in the form of words and is obsessed with assembling various body parts and imbuing them with life. It's Steve Murphy.
Yeah. Hi. What?
Cool. We're going through the entire discography of YouTube creators Radiohead. And this week, we're going to just slow things down a little bit and talk to somebody that honestly, like, they've been very polite and remained silent throughout the entire introduction, which is great. We love that. We love that. This guy's podcasted before. But also is somebody that I've wanted to talk to for a long time. And having a podcast about Radiohead is an excellent excuse to do that. We have on our show today, Joe Edelman.
Hello, gentlemen. Flattered and honored to be here.
I'm going to kind of introduce you and then immediately throw a question at you, and then that will be the formal start of our interview.
okay
Are you ready?
I'm ready. I was born ready.
Let's go. Joe, your YouTube channel is one of my favorites on the platform, genuinely. You post Radiohead covers from like a variety of eras, from singles to album tracks to B-sides. Some are collaborations and others see you playing every single instrument that is on the track. And you also make these great videos on insight into the band's writing and recording process, like how Tom plays rhythm guitar, how Ed makes all of those sounds. And you're in a Radiohead tribute band called There There, and you make your own music too. So obviously, music is a huge part of your life. So firstly, Joe, what is music?
What is music? Well, that's a big question with a lot of answers. What is music to me is it's a way of relating my experiences to the world and to others, and specifically vis-a-vis Radiohead, who are my favorite artist. I think they do a tremendous job of doing that, of finding both, you know, the beauty and sometimes the pain, but also the beauty and the pain of everyday life. And so I like music as a way of translating between those two realms, between emotion and kind of action. So that is what
that's
music
great.
Is to me.
That's such a good answer. Every guest's answer has been better than any answer that we've given. And anything that we could possibly hope to discover on this podcast.
I mean, that makes sense, because we get on guests who, you know, are in some way related to music and know about music, and we're just three fucking dickheads.
Right, okay.
Well,
so, okay. Speak for yourself.
No, we
didn't have a huge amount of conversation before the podcast, Joe, because I like to just sort of chuck guests in.
Sure.
There's slightly more nuance to us than just three fucking dickheads, I reckon.
I would hope so,
but,
I want to start at like the real basics, and it's questions that like everybody fucking gets asked, but I think that the answers are perennially interesting. Music, huge part of your life now. How long has that been the case?
It has been, let's see, I am now 31 years of age, and I began playing the guitar when I was 10 years old. In grade
school.
Oh,
wow, that's very young.
Yeah, I was inspired by a friend. Originally, I wanted to play the drums, which actually are still kind of secretly my backdoor favorite instrument, but I do love playing the guitar. Had a friend who started to play, and I was like, you know what, I'm going to play the guitar. And as Radiohead said, anyone can, so I had to drop the joke in there.
I wasn't
as committed. You know, I always enjoyed listening to music. I remember things that I would hear on the radio, or songs that my sister would listen to, or things, you know, that I appreciated in music. Obviously, it wasn't Radiohead at that point. But it kind of took a little while, and then certain artists, some of the kind of the greats of classic rock, you know, the Jimi Hendrixes and Led Zeppelins of the world, to really inspire me to want to get proficient on the instrument. And then it took me later into great songwriters like Tom York and Radiohead to really appreciate all the different ways that music can work, and not just in, you know, virtuosity on instruments and things like that. So it's been a long journey since being 10, and I've learned a lot in that time, and I'm still learning a lot, which is great. And that's what I love to do on the channel, is, you know, like you said, about kind of trying to analyze why I really like what Tom is doing or what Ed is doing musically and lyrically and things like that. So, yeah.
Yes, that's really interesting to me. Is one of my favorite things about your channel is that you seem to be learning at the same speed as everybody who's watching the channel, right? Like, you'll do a cover of something, and it will include like something that you've not tried before, or something that you haven't considered before, and it's kind of it's really organic. And they also aren't really they're not interpretive covers. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
Like you'll see people posting things like exit music for a film, but it's country music,
right?
And that's cool.
Yeah,
that's fine.
Does that exist?
Yeah, I think so. I wouldn't be surprised if there's a whole album of Radiohead country music.
Yeah.
But what your covers are is they are very impressive. I guess I'd call them recreations. They're almost not even covers. They're like,
I like to maybe like historical reenactment. The guy, the Revolutionary War guy. You
that's
know.
Great.
Oh, I thought you meant you've got a lute.
Yeah.
To be fair, I wouldn't put it past Radio. Yeah.
What is that process like? Like, first of all, how do you pick what you want to cover? Although I have a sneaking suspicion that your channel is going to try and cover every single song they've released.
That's kind of the big one. And people ask, they'll recommend songs in the comments, be like, you should cover this one. And either the answer will be like, oh, no, I did. And here's the link, and here's the video. Or every song's on the table. Like, you know, they'll mention a B-side. I'll be like, every song's on the table. You know, I've got the list. I actually was at one point maintaining kind of like a spreadsheet and check them off. Like, oh, I've done all of King of Limbs now, and I've done all of OK Computer. No method to the madness, really, like just kind of what catches my fancy. There were some that were requests where I said, OK, yeah, definitely I want to dive into this one now. But it's just whatever I'm listening to most at the moment or what inspires me.
OK, that's interesting. I mean, we have you on at this point of the podcast, having just covered The King of Limbs, and you've been on our list of guests since the beginning. But I kind of picked this era because this is the area the area of Radiohead that I associate you with, and I think it's because that's how I discovered your channel. It's because your covers of the songs from The King of Limbs, they're not. Maybe this is wrong. They're not covers of the studio versions, mm-hmm. right? They're covers of the live
right.
versions.
Right.
Stuff that Lucas and Steve and I just watched on the From the Basement session.
Yep.
And that's really interesting to me. And so it made me really curious about how you go about picking apart the songs. Is it always the case that you go to a live version or not?
It is often the case. I mean, sometimes I will, like, for example, I guess the song Dex Dark or certain songs where I'm really listening in for the studio arrangement, trying to replicate things like the choirs or the specific reverb effect that Johnny
yes,
does. And
yeah.
like, you know, if you listen enough to multiple versions, which I do because, of course, I have no time for other things. I'm just constantly listening to Radiohead and versions of Radiohead. You start to realize what the differences are, and then, you know, you can kind of pick and choose. In some cases, I skew way more towards the studio version. A lot of times, I do look at the live reference because the amazing thing about Radiohead and what they do, they do treat live versions almost like an entirely new song, and especially for The King of Limbs, right? Like that interpretation was so exciting because there was so much mystery around the album, and that was actually the album release, you know, around which I really became a huge fan because I was very much under a rock for a long time. I listened to OK Computer for the first time in college and it blew my mind. And then at that point, they were getting ready to release The King of Limbs. So that's kind of where I stepped into the picture. And so it was kind of the reason I chose to focus on it as like one of the first things that I did with the channel. I had done some OK Computer covers with my friends from my original band from college, Burn Holiday. And we did that, you know, over kind of the preceding summer. But as I got started doing things.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Didn't you cover the whole album?
We did, and that was kind of like our big college idea. When we were together as classmates and friends, we were like, let's put on a full OK Computer tribute show, and it didn't end up becoming a live show, but we ended up, you know, kind of doing it years down the road as, you know.
From the basement. You like kind of did your own From the Basement.
Yeah,
like
we were inspired.
Studio live OK Computer thing, yeah.
Absolutely, totally inspired by that kind of setting and those songs.
I hope you don't take this the wrong way, Joe. That's an insane thing to do.
You know, sometimes you gotta go a little crazy.
I hope you take that in the spirit that it's intended, because I also think it's an amazing thing to do.
No, absolutely.
So what goes into picking apart the songs then?
Yeah, so a lot of listening, and in this case, I have kind of primed myself over the years by just, like, you know, I do have a lot of different, you know, albums that end up on repeat, and I've listened to the songs, and when listening to the songs each time, kind of focusing on different elements. Obviously, the live videos are a huge help. So that's when I say, like, Radiohead reinterpret themselves live. But if you get, you know, with the beauty of today's day and age with performances like From the Basement or HD streams of festivals and things like that, you can wait for that critical moment where the shot, you know, the camera pans to Phil and you're like, oh, okay, that's the drum fill, you know, or what the heck is Ed playing, right? Because, like, I remember, so I collaborate often with a friend of mine from Japan, an artist named Taka, Koshinaka, and he goes by the name Fluffy Momo on YouTube. He was the guy actually who inspired me, really, to start doing what I did on YouTube, because I saw him make Faithful covers, and I was like, ooh, I want to do that. That seems like fun.
That's interesting. He has the... My sort of impression of him is he has a lot of the Johnny Greenwood stuff, like, really nailed.
He inhabits it. He really is, like, so good at that. Like, it's funny because
he has the same stickers on his guitar and stuff like that. It's really, really interesting.
Yeah, he is hardcore, and it's cool because, you know, like, when you say, like, what, how do you get at the details? Because the details, like, you can look up, and I certainly do. Like, I owe a lot of credit in terms of standing on the shoulders of giants or whatever, looking at other people's covers, looking at tabs. Like, when I'm figuring out parts, I don't do it all on my own. You know, there's things that I can piece together by ear and what have you. But when you see somebody play the same thing, but they can play it like a totally different way, and like so much of Johnny's sound, as I found out trying to play those parts myself, like on the covers where I do it, is that attitude. And Taka gets it. Like, it's just something in the attack of the pick on the strings, something in the posture, like, actually contributes to the feeling. And that's why they're one of a kind. And, you know, my covers are still, you know, even as close as I try to get them, they're still covers. But that's really cool to me, like, because, you know, you can, everybody borrows and steals to some extent, but the mannerisms or the ideas behind, you know, the thing, if you can take some of those and like put those same pins in your vest and then make your own style, right? Like, that's what I ultimately hope to do. And like, when people do say, I get, that's something I'm acutely aware of, like the cover, interpretive cover, which are great, like you said, like the country exit music, those kind of covers. Yeah, yeah. Like, one of my favorite songs is Jimi Hendrix's All Along the Watchtower, which was a Bob Dylan song, but now like Jimi right. Hendrix owns that song, you know? So,
yeah.
You know, you can put your own spin on thing and it being things and it can be great. Or like, what I think I'm doing is like kind of working with test tubes in a lab to kind of, you know, decompose it and then say, yeah. Ooh, I like that. You can make a synth sound that sounds like that. I'm going to shove that in some song that I'm messing around with, you know? So that's, I kind of take a different approach to it, but it is really fun to do it that way.
How long does like one cover take? I mean, it depends on the cover, obviously. Yeah,
it depends on the song. I have done them sometimes, like with, you know, ample, certain times where I've had more or less kind of free time, you know, and on and holidays and things like that. I can put them together in a couple days if I really know the song or there's less arrangement.
Oh, that's still quite a long time, huh? Yeah. A couple of days.
It could be as much as like a week. And it depends, you know, yeah, sometimes the number of takes offers. Because I wish, I'd love to say that I just go in there and hit record and it's one take on every instrument and I'm done. Yep. But yeah, I'm a perfectionist, so 18, 20 drum takes maybe if it's really hard, sure. You know, or, you know, going in there and, you know, doing the comping and things like that. So, yeah, it's a labor of love, though. I mean, I have a lot of fun doing it. Like, it's time just flies by. So I don't see it as, you know, too strenuous.
I mean, yeah, obviously, you have to be deeply in love with a band to do that kind of thing. What you started with Hendrix, and I always see the Zeppelin poster that's
in the back
in your YouTube videos.
Yep, yeah, exactly.
How did you go from that to Radiohead? What drew you to Radiohead?
So it was a good friend of mine and the member of the band in college that I was with, my roommate in college, Corey Furlong. He is like, oh, you know, I we'd always check out CDs at the local, there's an amazing record store in Princeton, New Jersey called the Princeton Record Exchange. It's been there for a long time. They have great, like, you know, budget CD walls, and you can kind of go and find a lot of different artists. So originally I'd be going and I'd be looking for the things that I was already kind of into, you know, different rarer Hendrix CDs or things like that. And I was obsessed with, like I said, like kind of the concept of guitar as like a be good at it for the sake of being good at it, like kind of the virtuoso school, the Eddie Van Halen's, the, which is amazing music. I mean, I still love listening to that music. Still amazing music. But sounds, like the idea of weird scales or like things that weren't influenced by the blues directly. So like when I heard Paranoid Android for the first time, so it was kind of like, he's like, you should check out OK Computer. So I bought the CD at the Record Exchange. It was like the fall of 2010, I think. And I listened to it like front to back and I was just like, whoa, like that's weird. And some of it I didn't completely get right away. You know, it challenged me in certain ways. It appealed to some of my other senses. But yeah, just like I heard this crazy, you know, kind of microtonal solo in Paranoid Android. And I was like, oh, so like that's kind of like a cool thing you can do with guitar or composition. Like that whole song obviously is a total like rock opera in and of itself. So I was like, yeah, it doesn't have to just be like 12 bar blues and like shredding. It can be this whole other thing. And then obviously Tom's voice and his lyrics made me focus more on singers and on moods and things like that. So
yeah, singers and moods, yeah. is a good shout for Radiohead. Very moody band.
Yeah.
And for sure.
People, I think, maybe take that and they, you know, everybody says like Radiohead is depressing. And
they're depressing.
And
right,
I can see like if you were to take several lyrics, perhaps out of context or sounds like, yeah, okay, you know, but like I said, I think the right word is more like bittersweet. Like some of the sounds on In Rainbows, like some of those concepts, they're secretly, I think, talking about life and death and love and all those things, but they do it in a way that doesn't feel like it's pandering and it's like sugar-coated and it doesn't feel like it's completely glum, like there's no hope. You know what I mean? I don't listen to Radiohead and feel like I'm hopeless. I feel like I'm hopeful, you know?
I have the same reaction. I wonder how much of the Radiohead are depressing comes from outside of the UK, because to me, Radiohead are just British.
Like, yeah, yeah. I think there's a little bit of a cultural barrier. Like, there's something that people don't get about that. Like, just not sardonic, like wit, you know, sardonic kind of thing. Like, there, you know, not calling it.
There's
like
a
it
lot
is,
of
but...
like. There's a lot of unexpected irony in Radiohead's music, I think. And have you ever been to the UK, Joe?
I have. In my last job, I did a bit of business travel there. I wish I could have stayed longer, and would love to come back.
Was it miserable? Was it miserable when you...
it was. No, I think the weather was like probably
it was classic, drizzle,
overcast, but not...
Gray.
It I loved it. I mean, it felt very homey to me. It was very nice.
Yeah. Well, that's because you listen to a lot of Radiohead.
Exactly. I'm very much a musical and cultural Anglophile, so that worked out, yeah.
It's interesting that you became a fan at the King of Limbs, because in all of the deeper dive stuff that we've just been doing, it's one that splits a lot of people, right?
Very polarizing, yeah. I often am, like many other, I guess, Radiohead superfans, trawling like the web forums and Reddit and places, and you see all those debates about, oh, this is the best album, this is their lower tier album, or the King of Limbs should have been re-recorded, it's terrible. But it's I am biased because it was kind of where I came in, you know, and like I have that sentimental attachment to the album, but I think that
adds a lot, right?
Yeah, I think that adds a lot. You know, obviously you can't separate the music you're listening to from like kind of the time and place you're listening to it and the people you first, you know, some things resonate with people that don't with others simply because of that whole other, you know, meta factor of the music. But those live interpretations, I think it comes down to, if they didn't ever play the songs live the way they did, I think I would still think the album is very cool and very experimental, and those textures are really beautiful and almost, you know, ambient and meditative. But the way that they pulled it off live and bringing in Clive Deamer and all those like amazing, tricky, polyrhythmic things that they did just made it super exciting, you know, to me. So I think it's one of my favorite albums, but then again, it's like choosing a favorite child. I don't have children, but it's like, you know, it's like... yeah, I don't know. They're all good.
I always think choosing a favorite child would probably be quite easy.
Yeah.
yeah. It's certainly easier than choosing a favorite Radiohead album. Anyway.
Exactly. Right.
That one's an idiot, and that one's great. Yeah, that's
you're
my
brilliant.
Favorite.
Yeah. I hate you. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
And Pablo Honey's an idiot. Is that what we're saying?
If we had to pick one, if I had to desert island, I'd say Pablo Honey. But not that there wasn't good ideas there. It's just that it wasn't as good as all the
others. But then the interesting thing is, like, there also seems to be a consensus around the King of Limbs being the one that's just above Pablo Honey.
I don't buy that.
Yeah. I mean, in terms of our ratings, that was kind of
where it sits.
I mean,
that is where it sits. Yeah.
Steve,
I think I went slightly below Pablo Honey, didn't I?
You prefer Pablo Honey to the King of Limbs, so, which is fine. Which is absolutely fine.
Joe, like what I found is that I didn't respond. I mean, I still liked it, but I didn't respond particularly well to Kid A. And then I saw them do all the business that they do live, and it's really grown on me. And it's like now, you know, up there with one of my favorite Radiohead albums. And we've just listened to King of Limbs recently, and that was the first time I've kind of experienced it. Mm-hmm. And I was not so hot on it. The first four songs were tough for me. I loved the last four songs. But we've just watched Live from the Basement. I'm like, hello. Okay. Mm. Oh, what's going on here? Yeah, I think it's going to be another grower. But because of that live element, and that's why I like your YouTube videos, because I can see you doing all the stuff. And we were just talking about earlier just the faithful covers you do. And my favorite thing, I was watching your Everything in Its Right Place cover today. The fact you've got the lemon shaker.
Yeah.
Gotta have a good lemon shaker. All those details. I love it. Yeah.
That is excellent.
It's a great shaker, too. It's got, like, it's funny. My drummer friends have been like, this has a great sound. I'm like, yeah, I don't know. It's just a lemon shaker. Johnny Greenwood was onto something. So,
I've never considered the different sounds of shakers, but then I don't have any shakers. I don't have any. I've got a tambourine. Listeners familiar with the podcast will have heard the tambourine loads. That is also kind of kind of a consensus as well, which is like, oh, I didn't get on with King of Limbs, but the live King of Limbs is at least very interesting. I think a lot of people prefer the live stuff of King of Limbs. Were you already kind of doing covers when the King of Limbs came out? Probably not, right?
No, so Corey and my other friends that we were active in a few different, you know, kind of bands and configurations on campus at school. We did it was called the Princeton University Rock Ensemble. So it was like we had this kind of big group that would put together.
It's not a great band name, I'm going to be honest with you.
It was more of a club, more of an extracurricular. And those guys were great. A lot of really good musicians that I met that way. But that was still sort of my older mode, like, 'cause we were putting on, like, you know, 13-minute productions of Layla or something, like, big and solo-y. Right. And, it wasn't as much the Radiohead thing, although some more alternative music kind of seeped its way into that as well, too. But no, I certainly wasn't doing YouTube covers back then when it first came out. And I don't think I even thought, gear plays a big part in what I do. Like, I know we joke about the microphone or certain synthesizers or sounds. Like, of course, I think the message I always want to get across when I make like some type of tutorial video or whatever is like, it's the wizard, not the wand. And you can get great sounds out of all types of gear, expensive or otherwise. But when I first listened to the King of Limbs and those kind of synthesizer sounds or those things, like, I don't even know how one would do that. And so it kind of took me a while for me to digest it and become familiar with other technologies, get better at keyboards or synthesizers and just like learn about that conceptually. And then I could start to kind of attack it and be like, okay, I think I know what that sound is on Identikit or something like that. So I
don't want to put words in your mouth, but I'm assuming that kind of the kind of recreation that you do has probably led to like at least a deeper understanding of Radiohead's work, if not a deeper appreciation.
But
then it must have also changed. You make your own music as well, mm-hmm. and it must have changed the way that you approach that, surely.
Yeah, absolutely did. I think in terms of sound design, like thinking about those concepts, I think if I had started, and I certainly did try to in some way write songs like back when I was more in guitar mode and in college and things, and they came out different because of the type of music I was listening to at the time. And I think the King of Limbs, for sure, of all the stuff in Radiohead's music, like Kid A is another big one, but in terms of introducing me to other scenes, electronica, trip-hop, like I'm a big fan of Portishead and things, you know, Damon Albarn, Gorillaz, and like different, just like mixtures of electronic textures.
Miserable British music.
miserable British music is my happy music.
Yeah.
I think it really is.
That's good. Me too.
I love it. Yeah. I don't know why, but so that, absolutely, like all the stuff, and I've maybe made a handful, like half a dozen, because I'm very much a procrastinator still. If you can believe it, despite doing all the stuff that I do for the channel, I have a hard time sometimes getting started, you know, obviously only ever so many hours in the day, but I've made sort of a handful of songs.
How do you combat the procrastination? That's something that is a question just for me.
Yeah, the answer is
that just you asking for tips there.
Yeah, yeah. It really helps.
Not well most times, but I do try to keep maybe like an open kind of to-do list or notes, like just knowing goals, like shots that I want to shoot in terms of either original song concepts or songs I know I want to cover. Like I have that hit list and it kind of focuses me a little bit to kind of look and know like this is what I want to go for. Or making lots of little voice memos, like when ideas happen, because oftentimes they don't. Like, I'm not in that mode. If I'm just picking up instrument, I might just be noodling completely aimlessly and nothing good should ever come of it. But every once in a while, something great comes out.
That's where I am. Yeah. Every day of my life, noodling endlessly, nothing good comes out of it.
Yeah.
I'd love to get to that next stage. I'd love to get to that next stage.
it's there. It's like fishing or something. I don't know. Like there's a bite, you know, and then you put it down somewhere and then hopefully come back to it within the next, like, you know, calendar cycle or something. But I'm doing a bad job at that. There's one song I've been wanting to put to tape for like better part of a year and a half now. And I don't know what's stopping me. It's there. It's almost done, but it's just not done. So
does the Radiohead stuff kind of get in the way of that a little bit?
It's interesting. Like sometimes maybe, I mean, I wouldn't, you know, it's like, yeah, I have a lot of different things I'm doing. And like you guys mentioned, most recently over the past year, I'd say I've become obviously more actively involved with the live, like I'm excited to do the thing that I do on YouTube, but now I'm partnered up with these great guys in They're There, the band that's the live tribute to Radiohead. And we play in like the New York, New Jersey, Philadelphia, kind of tri-state area, playing live shows. So that's a whole nother layer to it because, you know, you get to recreate the songs kind of in a studio environment or focus on that and then try to, you know, I mean, it's a little bit like skin grabbing, like, you know, like to try to, I you know, don't want to think that I'm Tom when I'm out there on stage, but it's kind of fun to play pretend, you know, for a couple hours with a bunch of like-minded Radiohead freaks, you know, to go to have fun with that. So that's a cool experience, but it's taken a lot of prep time and work for that too. So yes, it does sometimes, but I try to, when I can, make time for all three of those buckets. Yeah.
I was going to ask how there is, that must be a completely different experience to like meticulously nailing down parts that you're recording and then putting together. Because of course, because you play all of the, you know, if you cover something like, what did I show you? Did I show you guys Staircase, Lucas and Steve? We watched that together, right?
Watched it together a couple of days ago.
Yeah. And
recording King
Olympus. Obviously, you have to do the drums and then you do stuff over that and then you do stuff over that and then you do stuff over that. Whereas the kind of the live interaction that you do in there is completely different. How is it being in a Radiohead tribute act in that kind of live environment? I mean, we watched clips of that as well. Lucas, I remember you saying how much you appreciated that you guys don't like dress up like the band.
Yeah.
Like some tribute acts will do.
Yeah, there's that thing, right? Because then it becomes a bit more than just doing cover songs or tribute act. It then becomes almost a bit more of like a, I don't know,
trying to do an Oxford accent.
Yeah.
Yeah, like almost, like almost comes like a bit of like a play, almost. Mm-hmm. Like, are you in character? You know?
Yeah. That's the thing. Like, I still, people ask, it's like, oh, why, you know, how and why do you sing like Tom? And I'm like, I don't really think, I mean, like, I can understand certain qualities that are similar, but like, when I listen back to myself sing, or if I sing a song that I've written, I'm like, that sounds nothing like it, you know, because it's like, you know, you can only ever be you. And so I love the fact that those guys, like, we all get it. Like, we're having fun, super fun, super amounts of fun up there. And the people in the crowd are the same people as us. Like, they could be on stage, you know, like, they're the kind of musicians and nuts and fans of the band. So trying to keep things, like, organic and, not, like, doing too much of the, you know, kind of play dress up and pretend. You know, because, like, it's tempting because, I mean, it's fun. Yeah. But, like, you know, we respect that, you know. And a lot of respect for that performance because it is hard to do that up there.
I imagine it's hard to sing a Radiohead song and not do a bit of a Tom voice. Like, right, it's true of anything, right? You're singing along in your car to a band. You're doing, like, vaguely going to be doing an affectation of that singer.
Yeah.
Unless you very consciously make an effort not to.
Yeah. You can't sing along to Bob Dylan and not do a Bob Dylan voice.
Right, right, exactly. Yeah, because it's the voice is a little bit part of the persona. Right, yeah, exactly.
So. Are the power dynamics in the tribute act the same? Like, have you just kind of stepped up to be the front man, to be the kind of the Tom York figure? Are you going to go full diva mode as well? Are you going to do the full Tom York stroppy sort of stuff? Or
Exactly. Cool. I'm going to just be a total wreck at rehearsals. And
excellent.
We're doing it this way and drum machines only now. Cool. Yeah, so no, I have a lot of respect for those other guys because I've always loved playing with other musicians and they all have different, you know, like it's fun because it's like we're all from different backgrounds and levels of experience and playing in other bands. The guitarist who performs Johnny's role, and he's also like an excellent violin player and synthesizer player. He was in a Pink Floyd tribute. So, you know, it's like other, you know, great everybody. Yeah. We all like just love music and love paying tribute to it. It's more of a it's a pretty laid back experience.
Good.
But no, I originally joined actually. So they found out about me. They originally were in sort of a different formation. They saw my YouTube as well, and there was kind of like we talked about collaborating, and then their Ed O'Brien, you know, in quotes, left the band. And so I kind of jumped in that role, and that was super fun for me because, again, I have massive amounts of respect for what he adds to the sauce. And then went from there. Then the singer moved out back west, and so I joined and I slid into his role.
But then, you're not as super strict in terms of roles like that, are you? I watched that you have a full length show on YouTube, and you are in the Ed O'Brien role.
Yeah.
But also, you're playing the piano and stuff, which is not typically something Ed would do.
Right.
Yeah.
There's a little bit of musical chairs. We don't. Yeah. We try where we can to kind of, you know, recreate the bucketing, but we're flexible, and that in some ways we can make those, you know, kind of individual decisions that spice it up a little bit and make it a little bit different. Like, I think the violin is another example, like a great touch that obviously they,
right.
Radiohead doesn't feature as much actual live strings live, but Ben's an excellent violin player. So that's cool to have that.
That's something that you guys have that Radiohead doesn't. I don't think they've ever used like strings live, right?
Yeah, no, because even in like the From the Basement stuff, they were using horns, but they weren't using strings. I don't think so. That would be great if they did. Like, I think of Portishead at Roseland in the night. Like, that would have been a cool.
Right.
If they did,
yeah.
People wanted them to do that for Moonshaped Pool because that is a very orchestral album.
That would have been perfect. Yeah.
Awesome.
I would have liked that. I think we were almost like semi expecting it because you're just like, well, how do you do that album without the strings? And I saw them at the Roundhouse on that tour, which is a little venue in London.
Yep.
And I don't know. This is the thing. You'll have to tell me. I don't know how they do it. Like, as far as I'm concerned, I heard strings. But but there was no strings on stage. I've got no idea what's going on.
Yeah. I think between, like, synthesizers and, like,
whatever
I want to say, like,
Ed
envelope
does.
Contest. Yeah, Ed. So yeah. Ed doing things on the guitar with... his sustainer and with Ebos and things like you can kind of make violin type attacks out of guitars. And obviously Johnny's got the Owen Martineau, that really awesome French instrument that's very vocal. So that kind of gets a little bit of a string sound too, I think.
Yeah. You talked about the way that you pick songs for YouTube, which is kind of, it must be just like whatever you kind of feel like doing at the moment and whatever you want to dig into.
Yeah.
But for there, is your set list like somewhat dictated by what the audience will want? Because I think for tribute acts, there's almost more pressure on you guys to like provide the hits than there is on Radiohead at this point, right?
Yeah, exactly, right. So yeah, it's to make it a whole meta experience, we can pretend that we're living in 1995 or something and that people just want us to play Creep like 20 times in a row
exactly.
As opposed to anything from Kid A. But no, I mean, we're lucky that the people that we have like met at these shows that come to the shows, they're mostly kind of super fans like us. And so when they hear something, like for the first time we did at our last show, we were in Rhode Island and we played Jigsaw Falling Into Place, which, you know, even Radiohead, they're not really doing that one live that much anymore.
Yeah.
So like, and somebody kind of in the crowd, you know, had requested it and we did it and it was like, all right. Like, you know, like just like people like the deeper cuts and the things that are, so we feel ultimate, you know, kind of freedom to do what we want with the set list, but we try to do creative things. So we do some themed things like, last year, I think it was, we did kind of the 25th anniversary for OK Computer, because 2022. And so we did a full OK Computer set in the middle of our other set, right, when we played shows.
Right.
This year, since it's the 20th anniversary of the Glastonbury 2003 performance, which I think is obviously one of their most excellent, memorable shows,
crazy.
We're doing that set list plus some extras. So,
oh, cool.
We're kind of doing a lot of Hail to the Thief that way. So it's really kind of like a backdoor... Hail to the Thief show, but with other stuff sprinkled in. So
you guys get
to
do the gloaming.
That's cool.
Yeah.
you guys.
That's where you're really like, yes, now I know. Like, it's just, it's very fun to do. It's kind of become a meme amongst like people who go to the shows are like, oh God, it's the gloaming again. But when you play it, you're like, it's kind of fun. I don't know. It's groovy little.
It looks fun to play.
It's very fun.
Not that fun to watch.
Not as fun to watch as it is to play. So, what I don't know what we can do to bring people into the experience, have them have interactive, like they can control the loops or something, you know, make it a.
Oh, that would
I
be
mean,
excellent.
That sounds like a great idea.
I'm going to write that down somewhere. Yeah, if I can figure it out.
It would end up sounding dog shit because people
would
just be like,
it would. It certainly would. But that's my other role within the band is kind of technical director to try to figure out how to route audio into our chaos pads or things like that. So I'm the one always thinking about like, oh, what if we plugged X into Y? So I am actually writing that idea down, but I don't know how feasible it really is. So.
Well, that's a big thing I wanted to talk about, but at the risk of getting very dry is gear. Like the gear that you have is, we've talked about the microphone already, obviously. The lemon shaker,
sure.
It's one of the more impressive bits of gear that you have, but also like, so you talked about synths and wanting to be like you can recreate these sounds on like cheaper alternatives to these synths. But also, Joe, correct me if I'm wrong, you do not have the cheaper alternative to the synths.
I'm lucky to have some very very beautiful instruments of all types. So
that was kind of my question: is did you find did you kind of realize that's the instrument that they are using and then want to recreate that sound? Or is it just something that you'd always wanted and this was the perfect excuse? Or is it, it might be both?
Yeah, I think a little bit of column A and a little bit of column B definitely was motivated. Like, so the biggest one would be like the Dave Smith, the Prophet, like the Prophet yes. synthesizer. I mean, the great thing about the Prophet is, you know, its lineage. Like, if you think of, I mean, it was one of the first and biggest like synthesizers in the world when it came out in the 80s and has been on so many different styles of music. And because it is kind of timeless, so it's kind of cool that Radiohead came to it at around that time, the King of Limbs, right? When they kind of wheeled it out for a Staircase and things like that and get those. I think of them as like, they're like Blade Runner sounds in my head, like the movie Blade
exactly
Runner. Like, I love the Vangelis, like the soundtrack, like just like, so that aesthetic you can easily coax out of instruments like that. You certainly can out of others, but people always say like the mojo in a synthesizer is something to do with like its filter section and it's also like something about the way that that Prophet synth sounds is really fantastic. And just in doing, you know, I got it. I was like, I don't know how to use this. That was the first kind of like, you know, panicked moment where I was like, I'm not actually really that good at synthesis, but doing the covers kind of motivated me to be like, oh, like this is what, you know, filters do and what envelopes do and how you can add vibrato to a sound or do this, right? So learning that stuff made me, now I feel like I can pick up most, you know, synthesizers or software or plugins and kind of get to what I want because I know, because I learned on a really, really great synth with like, you know, really great features. So
that is something that at the risk of embarrassing you, your videos have done for me is like, I had absolutely no clue how to start playing around with delay until you did your the video on how Johnny uses delay on King of Limbs and a Moon Shaped Pool, like the Staircase one.
Yeah,
blew my mind.
Me too. It still does. I think like I that was the first, I think, kind of tutorial type. I had made covers before that. That was like the first tutorial video I did. And when I did that, I was like, oh, this is fun because I'm actually kind of making a mental note of something I found cool and maybe it will help somebody else because those tricks are like, they're not, you know, I'm sure Johnny was not the first person in the world to use the dotted eighth delay thing. Actually, that would probably be like the Edge or something, but actually not even him, right? Somebody else did it before him, but he does it in a way that's very clever. And that, that Staircase one is an awesome example, like delay as a harmony effect. Very cool.
Yeah, it's really cool. Yeah. And then you were saying, oh, it blew your mind as well. So then how did you come to the realization that that's what he's doing? Are you using other resources or is it by ear or what's going on in your brain?
It's. I wish I knew. Explain yourself. Yeah, no, in some cases, happy accidents and yes. And in some cases, again, I rely on other great friends and resources. So like I mentioned, Taka in Japan, like he, because he has also focused so hard on studying. Because the thing I was thinking of earlier when I was saying, like, you wait for a good live camera angle, like Taka sent me a clip of Ed's fingers on the guitar during Desert Island Disc. And he's like, this is how I figured it out. See? And he like plays that like chromatic thing. I was like, oh, okay. So now I see what he's doing because it's all blurry with all
that's
the delays.
So like, detailed.
Yeah.
That's
so
crazy.
I get great tips from him or from... There's an excellent website, I don't know if you guys have seen, called thekingofgear.com. There's
absolutely.
A fantastic gentleman who, he builds his own pedals. I've used some of his pedals, and they're great at recreating those kind of sounds, but he's a wealth of knowledge. So between ear, happy accidents, other resources kind of lead me. So in some cases, I'm more of a collator of ideas. Like I would say, like in the Ed video about how to play like Ed, like I actually kind of, I helped him, he helped me script doctor it a little bit to think about like the exact references about these delays or things like that, right? So I'm both an assimilator of knowledge as well as some of it, you know, happen to be original.
That's interesting. It seems like a hard job, to be honest with you. How much of the sounds that you make is dependent on the gear? Like how much gear is sought out because you want to do something that's very specific in a Radiohead song?
Yeah. I would say definitely my selfish obsession, like the things that I choose and I get them because it's like, yeah, like I want that sound or that look or that feel. But knowing that I have tried things in other contexts, like I know there are other ways to build the mousetrap. But so I don't know if it's 50-50, 60-40, 80-20, you know, like sometimes you need a, you know, I don't know. I guess like in the guitar, the best analogy is like, if you're going to play Jimi Hendrix and like not use like a Stratocaster, like you should probably use a Stratocaster, right? Like, because I mean, like you could probably play Jimi Hendrix on a Les Paul, but
please don't.
Will it sound, you know, it's going to feel, because it's a little bit about like feeling it too, like, you know, those little like intangibles about it, right? So the Prophet, yeah, I mean, I could, I don't know, I'm trying to think of other good examples. There are other great synth makers out there, but Prophet's king.
Yeah, that Prophet is amazing. Like you just said, like some of that will come from, so some of the kind of input on stuff like that will come from Parker or the King of Gear, or there's actually loads of people and places out there who are dedicated to dissecting whatever it is that Radiohead are doing on their songs at any given second. What is it about, like, why are we like this? Like, what is it about Radiohead that kind of attracts people like that? Because I can't think of loads of other examples of modern bands that have that kind of aspect to them.
I think because they themselves, like, they are kind of like a science experiment as a band. Like, you know, they have stated, I think, in interviews and, like, the way that they approach their relationship with gear, they're like, yeah, we're just going to try this. We're going to mix strings with drum machines. We're going to do, like, they have themselves like a very honest and genuine, like, openness to experimenting with all types of gear from like all different periods of time, old tape echoes, new modular synthesizers, like whatever it may be. And it's cool because then, yeah, you just learn it. You don't just think in terms of like, you know, guitar into amp into fuzz, but like certain things, like there are certain sounds that are classic and threadbare, but there are layers to Radiohead's music. Like, that's the main thing I think people that maybe not even as deep into like musical analysis kind of pick up on, like, hey, there's a lot going on. I don't exactly know what it all is at all times, and it makes you kind of want to like peel back, you know, the onion and try to figure out, you know, what each contribution is. Not to say that there aren't, like, I mean, then they themselves I think are influenced by plenty of other music that is like that, you know, experimental electronica or things that you're like, oh yeah, like, it's, you know, it's not the only music, but compared to some more straight ahead forms of, you know, like alternative rock, you know, to use maybe another British example, like Oasis. I don't know.
Right.
Like, Oasis is great, but there's not that much there. I had a very strong affinity for Oasis for a time before Radiohead. I wouldn't say I listen to them as much now, but there's not as much to that in terms of sonics and depth.
Yes, there's not pages and pages worth of the internet dedicated to finding out how Noel Gallagher turns on his distortion pedal. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's interesting that you said, like, peeling apart, like, figuring out how the individuals contribute to the whole, because a recurring question, especially from Lucas on this podcast, has been, what the fuck is Ed doing?
What's Ed doing on this song?
Yeah, how could Ed?
And then the answer turns out to be loads of bits of business.
Everything. Loads of stuff. Yeah, everything. Yeah, exactly. You mentioned something earlier that I hadn't even considered, because I'm so focused, because I'm a musician as well, I'm so focused on like the audio side of stuff that you were talking about, like, oh, what I need, I've got a shot that I need to complete. I need to figure out what I'm shooting today. Hadn't even considered that there was a visual component to what it is that you do, but of course there is, because it's YouTube. Is being a YouTube creator as brutal as it seems?
I don't even know, because I don't even think I'm doing it. I don't want to say like the word right, but like I watch a lot of YouTube. As much as I make stuff for it, I'm like always consuming YouTube videos.
Yeah,
sometimes that's where a lot of my like little bits of knowledge and things that I pick up about synths or guitars, wherever it comes from. But the ones that I follow that I know seem to do it a lot, and as like their primary thing, that sound, it seems pretty grueling to me, because like, yeah, even for me, like, I, you know, I love doing this because of, you know, like what I am doing is fun to me, and like it's worth, like, I like making the videos. But to shoot like a tutorial video, yeah, I've got to think about what I'm gonna say. I gotta like plan it out, make a script, kind of rehearse it a little bit, set up all the effects, think about the camera angles, edit that, wait for it to render, publish it, you know, like all that stuff. Yeah, it takes time, and it can be a little bit like mindless at a time where you're kind of like, oh, like I did all this and like the end. But then, you know, when the video hits or it connects, or like somebody's like, this is great, like I didn't know that and now I do, I'm like, oh cool, like that's why I did it, because like I was having that thought and I just wanted to put it out there. So I find that YouTube is an awesome forum for that kind of thing. Like I'm really lucky to have it, you know, in that way as a consumer and a creator.
Yeah, I mean, I mean, Lucas, don't you spend something like 80% of your life on YouTube or something? Is that right?
80% of my waking hours.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not an exaggeration, but it's definitely become my, like, if I'm just going to, like, I'm just going to stick something on a screen because I can't, you know, I can't have silence because then...
Can't be alone with your thoughts.
Then the thoughts come in and that's...
Got to keep the thoughts away.
That's not a good shout. Yeah. Like, the default now is YouTube.
Yeah.
Like, I pay for YouTube Premium. What fucking stupid thing to do is that?
No, it's great. No, I love it. I haven't watched an ad in years, and it's fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, it's great, but it costs as much as Disney Plus and Amazon Prime put together.
Yeah, it's a lot.
It does over here. Disney Plus in America is a bit more expensive, I think.
They do stuff with, like, bundling
is
now.
Is that good insight? Is that something? Or shall I edit that out? I'll probably edit. No, I'll leave it. I'll
leave it. Are we going to, did you have any other, do you have a sponsorship with Amazon Prime or something? Is this going to get?
Yeah. I wish.
Isn't Disney bad? Amazon's great.
Oh yeah, there's not Amazon's done no wrong. Yeah,
yeah, no wrong at all. There's nothing wrong with that guy.
On today's episode, I'd like to talk to you about Buzzsprout, the user-friendly podcast hosting for non-techie people. I think that if this podcast has achieved anything, it's showing that literally anybody can start a podcast. Do you need any previous experience? No. Do you need top-of-the-range audio equipment? No. Do you need entertaining or insightful content? Absolutely not. But there is one thing that you will need, and that's podcast hosting or somewhere to store your podcast and deliver them to all of those podcast places, like the one where you're listening to this now. So if you're thinking about starting a podcast, just do it. We here at Big Mates Enterprises use Buzzsprout to host and publish our podcast because it's the best and easiest way to launch, promote, and track your podcast. Your show can be online and listed on all the major podcast directories within minutes of finishing your recording. That's Apple Podcast, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Overcast, Castbox, Pocket Cast, Podbean, Podcast Addict. The list goes on and on. The other thing we've found is that not only do you get useful and easy to understand statistics about how well your podcast is doing, but also that the support team is super helpful with somebody always on hand to answer questions and help our podcast succeed. Join over 100,000 podcasters already using Buzzsprout to get their message to the world, and you'll get a great-looking podcast website, audio players that you can drop into other websites, detailed analytics to see how people are listening, tools to promote your podcasts, and much, much more. But wait, because the more is now! Because if you follow the link in our show notes, when you sign up, it lets Buzzsprout know that we sent you. And do you know what that gets you? $20 worth of credit when you sign up for a paid plan, and that warm feeling in your stomach knowing that not only are you on your way to podcast greatness, but that you've helped support this show too. So if you're starting your podcast or you're looking to move your podcast, use Buzzsprout and follow our link in the show notes. Back to the episode.
I set you a very difficult task, Joe, that I set all of our guests, and I'm wondering if you've completed it or if you haven't, or if you've fallen apart, or if it's impossible.
All those things were possible at one point, but I am happy to say that I did do it, and I did it from the lens you described, and I picked from my angle the top 10 songs that I've covered, so like my favorite covers that I've done.
Your top 10 covers that you've already done? Okay.
Yes.
Cool.
Yes.
Okay, what I'm going to do then is I'm in the show notes, I'm going to link to every single YouTube video for your top 10. So people will be able to check these out as they go if they want to. Should we do it the traditional way? Do you want to do 10 to 1, or should we start from 5 and work our way out?
So the order itself is, my caveat is I didn't think very carefully about the order. So I love them all, as I said, with the albums. You've, like, I don't think
you've we locked could be, it in. This
we could do
definitive.
7, 3, 5, 6, 2.
Nah,
you know, like,
sorry, this is
matter.
Definitive. This is definitive. Whatever you say first is going to be number 10. Whatever you say last is going to be number 1.
Basically, your list is in an odd time signature.
The list is in an odd time signature. Yeah. True to form, this list is not in an even time signature. Yes. Yeah.
So it's always 4-4.
Always 4-4.
Secretly, it's sort of 4-4.
Yeah. Yeah. Who was it that was talking to us today about you just, it's fine if you just always count in ones? Was that on
everything's
our
in
1-1 today? Yeah, everything's in 1-1. Once you finish counting one, you count the next one. Anyway, right. Sorry. Yeah. I'm quoting people from our fucking online forum. Okay.
They have better takes than us most of the time. Yeah.
Exactly.
Of course. Go for it, Joe. Yeah. I definitely want to hear this.
Number 10, I have as Kid A, the song. So the song from the album.
Great song.
Yes. Fantastic song.
really fun experience to cover that, because I and my collaborators, who were Taka from Japan and a fellow named Josh Siemens Jones, who's actually, I believe, from the UK. He's an owned Martineau player, so he plays the thing that Johnny does, the thing that kind of sounds like a theremin, the very ethereal sounding instrument. So he played the melody on the own Martineau, and I sang, like, spoke the words, and we did the vocoding. So we tried to get the
way they recorded the studio version.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Oh, that's cool. Well, so that now was, like, I have to watch that.
That was our favorite, like, reenactment cover. Like, it was the least interpretive, because we actually went to try to do. And I sat there for a few hours transcribing the chopped up drum loops, because Phil plays some drums, acoustic drums in the song, but you can tell that they're clearly chopped and spliced.
Yeah,
I wrote it out and then tried to play it continuously as, like, one thing, right? And then made the electronic layers underneath that. So building it all together, Taka had the perfect, like, marimba sounding synth patch that did what Johnny was doing. Like, it just, when we listened to it back, we're like, oh, that's cool. It gave me that same kind of rush that listening to the studio track for the first time did. So that was a really fun one. Was kidding.
Have you thought about getting an Ons Martineau for yourself? I mean, I don't know. Do they cost like 50 grand or something? I don't actually know.
So the real deal ones, the ones made by, I think there's a French craftsman that is still, like, in the lineage or tradition of the Martineau family that makes them. And I believe those are like 10 grand plus. There is, I don't know, out of frame back there.
Yeah.
That is that's the Ondomo, which is from Japan. There's a craftsman, Nayuki Omo, who makes those. He made like two different small batch runs, and I was lucky. I think Taka somehow got me on the list to hear about the second. So yeah, I couldn't resist, and it is fantastic. So amazing. It's a beautiful instrument. I love the way it sounds and how expressive it is. So yes, I did go that far down the rabbit hole to get an Ons Martineau.
And everyone, subscribe to Joe's YouTube, and then, you know, eventually just build up enough cash to go and get an original.
Yeah, get the original.
Thank
get
you.
The,
yes, if I can get the original 1920 whatever Martineau someday.
Easy.
Be great. Easy money.
eBay. eBay's where you get secondhand stuff.
Yeah, eBay.
Right?
Yeah, eBay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Craigslist, they do secondhand stuff, right?
Yeah, they do. I think the odds of a vintage Ons Martineau showing up on a Craigslist are probably...
You never know, though. Someone who just doesn't know what they've got. It's like their grandson had it, right. And they're just like, I don't know what this is.
You're talking about it like it's a Pokemon card.
Yeah,
like someone's
accidentally
put a Charizard up or something. Like, yes, I don't think it's going to happen.
That is an apt comparison.
Yeah, do check. Okay, Kid A. We've got Kid A.
Okay, number 10, Kid A. Number 9, The Trickster. B-side from the Benz era, I believe.
These guys won't know that song.
No.
Okay. It's a rocker. It actually, interesting, I know you guys had a previous season on Muse.
Yes.
To me, because I don't know if you know, there's kind of like an internet flame war between Muse, Coldplay, and Radiohead fans. Like, some people like to draw.
We're quite familiar.
Okay, I'm sure you're aware. To me, if somebody wants to say, like, why does Muse sound like Radiohead or Radiohead sound like Muse, like, that song, something in, like, the operatic chorus vocal reminds me a little bit of Matt Bellamy when he sings that.
Interesting. That scratchy guitar sound is very showbiz as well.
Yeah. Something in that, like, kind of the fuzzy sound. It's one of their rockier songs, but it's got a cool twist to it. So that was really fun. That one I did with Taka as well. I mean, he got the Johnny, just like that, that pick scratch down to that.
But then the question is, in terms of, like, happenstance influence and direct influence and stuff, because I've seen people point at the Trickster and go, oh, Muse, you know, probably kind of took this as their sound a little bit. Do we think Muse were sitting around listening to B-sides from the Benz? Maybe not.
Probably not.
Possibly. I mean, it's not outside. I mean, there were musicians who were clearly fans.
Like, they did like the Benz.
You listen to B-sides. Why would they not?
Never heard a B-side in my life.
Oh, wow.
So I don't even really understand what they are.
I think the answer is that they were both listening to Jeff Buckley in the 90s. I think, like, both Tom and...
Yes.
I think, you know, I'm a massive Muse fan, but I think, you know, I'll happily admit that Muse heard the Benz and then went, showbiz?
Let's do that. Yeah. Let's try and do that.
Let's do that.
I am also a Muse fan. It's like, I love it all. So, big Muse fan as well, too.
How are Muse doing in the US at the moment? We're fascinated by how Muse are
because
doing
this
in the US.
We're talking about this just today because of this
iHeart Radio Festival where they were billed below Jack White, which caused
they were third
much...
on the bill, and to me that's wild because I'm like, Muse are a headliner. They only headline. That's all they do. They're huge, but that's obviously the UK, their star though, is obviously fading somewhat because
I think so. I don't know. Yeah, like the peak Muse. I think the peak Muse in the US. Like I remember, like when Black Holes and Revelations came out. I feel like they were on. They made more like late nights and then like late night appearances and then on to bigger stages. Like you know, Starlight was a huge song and all that stuff. Second Law, they did the dubstep stuff, and that was kind of like, that was kind of that might have been the jumping the shark. I loved that album, but it was like a little bit maybe Muse's, and then Drones, and now I'm just going through the Muse. Yeah.
Resistance was when they went from you know medium gigs to they could tour the same tour in the US as they would in the UK. Like
Resistance is definitely.
Is that kind of dipping now? And they maybe well, they're, I mean they're third behind Jack White and Chili's, so. I guess
Jack, well,
yes.
I mean, Jack White's been around for a long, long time too. I mean, if you count the White Stripes, yeah, it's not like they're not that far. Like early 2000s is kind of both of them. I feel like coming onto this, right? Like the White Stripes and them, but yeah, Jack White's been really. I don't know. He's just like he's kind of that Willy Wonka of rock thing. Like he's got all the business and you know ventures.
That's such
and,
a good description.
He is right. Great. He's kind of like the Willy Wonka of rock and roll.
I think Jack. We talked about this.
Timothy Chalamet is going to play him in a movie, isn't he?
Yeah, exactly.
We talked about this over WhatsApp, Lucas and Steve. Is that Jack White probably just has had more influence on like music in general than Muse, and it probably just tips him over in terms of billing. But I think in the UK it would be the other way around.
Yeah,
for sure.
But in terms of show, because like I have seen Muse live, like it's you know like I mean if you think about like Queen or the tradition of arena rock, like they're an arena rock band, and it's awesome to see them live because they totally embrace that. But Jack White's show is great too. I've seen him too. But I, you know, Muse in terms of like a headline show, I could see that. I could see why that might be controversial.
It'll happen eventually. That I'll see it happen. There'll be the album cycle where they are second billed on a major UK stage. Or the headliner secondary stage or something, and we go, here it goes. It begins. The gradual creep down.
They haven't sold out their stadium tour in this country, have they, this year? It's still on sale, which is interesting for me. That should have gone. If it was 5 years ago, that would have been sold out in an hour.
Yeah,
interesting.
It's kind of crazy. Yeah.
Number eight.
This is the Muse tangent.
On that note, it's another B-side. This is "These Are My Twisted Words."
Okay, I didn't realize you'd even covered that. Why?
Because I don't do a good job, probably, of like. Organizing and collecting. This is one I think it ended up probably why is because for a while Taka and I would like split covers across our channels, you know, to kind of, you know, share the audience and things like that. So I think that one we may have posted to his channel. It is interesting in our context here because it was kind of like a transition point between In Rainbows and The King of Limbs. It came out before The King of Limbs. And I think at the time people weren't even sure if it was like a real release or a bootleg. It kind of like dropped, you know, surprising. And it was a very murky kind of
torrent it before it was actually out. I remember seeing a YouTube video of it before they actually put it on their website. It was weird.
But in terms of the kind of the influence, like 70s like krautrock in the drumming, like that drum loop thing, which was pivotal for I think like King of Limbs and that sound, that kind of like looped drum sound, it was super fun to play. Very tiring to play that beat for that long. And just weird time signatures. I mean, that's like one of the classic, I think it's seven. It's in sevens or maybe fives. I forget. But yeah, just like a cool
Steve's
puzzle.
The drummer. Steve, you're going to have to figure out if it's fives. Or I doubt you remember the song that well.
No.
The drums are in four, I think. No. But
the rest is in vibes.
The rest, the guitar arpeggio is...
Radiohead.
I think it's seven. Yeah, it's Radiohead.
It's Radiohead. Yeah.
Radiohead.
Yeah. But great song.
Cool.
Number seven is Bloom from The King of Limbs.
That's got to be a difficult one to recreate, right?
It was. Lots of drumming. Lots of different types of drumming. I didn't have, at that point, I didn't have like the Roland I later did get. But I didn't have the Roland pad that Clive uses to do that.
Right. Yes,
roll
we've
from the
just
beginning. So
seen
I was doing
him
it,
using that. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I was just doing it on a little Korg, one of those little Korg finger pad things or whatever. So the camera was shaking. I didn't even have, you know, my camera was not what I use now. You know, I had like just my iPhone camera and it's like shaking in the video. You can see it. But early in my YouTube career. but it was a lot of fun because I love that song. That's one of my favorite ones from The King of Limbs Live. So.
Yeah, the way that they transform that is really interesting. You must have done a version that was not the basement version. I'm assuming you didn't have horns and stuff in.
So I in oh, lieu okay. of the horns, here we go.
Oh, I no, used... I thought you were going to say you had a whole brass band in your.
I had a whole brass band yeah. that I brought down here and into the basement. Yeah. I wish I did at the time. I mean, I know some horn players now, but yeah. I used the synth. I used the Prophet, and I tried right. to get as close as I could to like a brass patch, and then I transcribed the part and just played it in two different layers to kind of simulate the two. I guess it was either flugelhorn or trumpet parts, I think. Yeah.
Interesting. That's endlessly fascinating to me. Okay, cool. Bloom.
Yeah, so Bloom 7. Number 6, I have Let Down. But that doesn't... I feel weird now having it at 6 because, again, I didn't think about the numbering, and Let Down is perhaps my favorite, or if not one of my favorite, songs by the band. You know, I was going to say Full Stop, but that would be confusing because that's also a song by
really
the band.
Confusing.
It's one of my favorite songs, all things considered, Let Down. But fun, very fun to play. You know, like when you embrace the song, again, listening to the song provides a lot of emotion, but playing the song and kind of inhabiting its space and with the different guitar time signatures and things like that, very uplifting.
Lots of weird
song.
Meters and stuff going on in that one, right?
Yes, the Johnny is playing in 5/8, I believe, and and Ed may be keeping like just sort of like a 4/4 thing going, but it's really like the different kind of ping-ponging, like the downbeat of the drums and like where his little accents of those different notes kind of come in, which is really exciting, adds to the texture.
Which is really not something that even really occurs to you on like first listen of that song when you don't listen to Let Down and go, oh, this is fucking weird. Do you know what I mean?
I remember it's, I looked at a tab book for it. I was back in college. I was like, this was one of the songs in the album, OK Computer. I was like, this is beautiful. And I looked at the tab, I was like, wait, this seems wrong. Like, that. How do you even count that? Like, you know, how do you play? How do you remember what to do there? And then I figured out where he was actually repeating the pattern didn't line up with everything else. I was like, oh, okay. So it's like that's what he's trying to do. That weird syncopated feeling that informs a lot of their music. So yeah, it's a cool one.
That's a really interesting way of describing Radiohead's music. I think actually is you listen to it and it's beautiful and it's arresting. And then you look at how it's played and you go, no, this seems wrong. I don't think that's right. I don't think that's what it is at all.
Yeah. Yeah. On that very topic, number 5,
Love
things
it.
You think
nice.
This can't be right, is Pyramid Song, which is in right. fact in 4/4.
It's always 4/4. It's always 4/4.
Everything's 4/4. Everything's 4/4.
If you try hard.
Everything's 4/4.
If you try hard enough.
It's 1/1. Yeah. Four different 1/1s. And Philip Selway was just in an interview talking. Somebody asked him, he's like, how did you figure out the beat to Pyramid Song? He's like, I'm embarrassed, but it's just 4/4. And it's like, well, give yourself a little credit, Phil. Like, it's very syncopated and very. So Tom's piano, it's actually like a bossa nova, like a clave beat, like
it's
stretched
swung,
out,
right?
Yeah, it's
is
like a
right?
swung bossa nova type beat with the piano chords.
Joe, I don't even really know what that means. I've seen it because I'm not a drummer,
like,
man.
It's like
so Steve is a drummer, and I've seen it written down that it's incredibly swung, and I'm just repeating that to you now to make myself look clever. Mm. Did it work?
Oh, of course.
Okay,
I think you're the cleverest person here.
Thank you.
Sorry, guys. No, yeah. I just, you know.
Best guess.
It's never in question. But yeah, very fun song to play, and another one of my favorites to see live with them when Johnny's doing the he does the bow harmonic. So basically, he takes the violin or the cello bow, and he's got this, you know, his string on his guitar, and he's just like putting his finger lightly along it and just exciting like the different notes of the harmonic series or whatever. And it just gets that like weird whale sounds, kind of funky noise going on, which is cool. Cool detail.
Yeah. Good live band, Radiohead, I reckon.
Good, you know, they're pretty good live.
Good band, I reckon, in general.
Yeah,
good band.
Good band.
On the whole.
Turns out. Yeah. Turns out.
Pretty great. All right. Turns out. Yeah. Number 4, My Iron Lung. I had fun with this one. This was one I did all the parts for, and I was doing some playing around with like the different distortion sounds, because this is a big one for like Johnny's distorted sound. So getting that kind of, I think it's like the pedal that he uses is the Marshall Shredmaster. So I had the King of Gears kind of recreation of that to give me that like really bitey distortion. And I had the pickups in my Telecaster modded to be like those kind of very direct sounding pickups that he has in his Telecaster. So it was fun kind of letting loose on that one. And doing like Ed's part was he used the Ebow, which is that like sustain thing where he just kind of like puts it, it's like, and it just vibrates forever, and you can kind of do all these crazy pitch bends and things with it. So, yeah, that was a fun one to cover for sure.
The Ebo, he has a similar kind of thing built into his guitar now, right? He has a sustain.
Yeah, so I don't know if they were the first company to do it, but Fernandez, I believe the Japanese company, make a pickup, the sustainer pickup, which does, it's like a magnet that excites the string, and then the other string, the other pickup picks it up or whatever. So it does that, but across all the strings.
It is very exciting. Mm. Yeah.
It's so exciting.
It's an exciter. It's literally exciting. Yes. Exciting.
And then that is his Fender signature.
That's his signature Strat.
Do you have one?
Yes, I do.
How is it? Because I've been considering. I'm thinking of trading in my Jag and getting one. Do you think it's worth it?
I think so. I think it's one of the most unique guitars probably that Fender currently makes because of that, right? Because it's got the Strat thing, but it's also the sustainer thing, and that thing that it does is very unique. Like I you can do similar things with an Ebo, or you can do similar things with certain synth pedals, but it's just a fun thing, and you can get all sorts of cool textures. I used that guitar on one of the original songs that I most recently did, and like it was cool. Like I think Ed says in all the promo videos for it, he's like, I want people to take it and do, you know, crazy things with it. Like, it's a great guitar for that. Great guitar to think outside of the box and make those kind of sounds with the sustainer. So yeah, I recommend it.
His promo video for that signature guitar is one of the most Ed things I've ever seen.
It's very Ed.
It's so pretentious, but also so like earnest. It's wonderful.
Oh, so
doesn't it have shots of him like playing it in the woods and stuff?
Yes.
Yeah. It's lovely.
He is very one with nature.
It's fantastic.
I was going to say, is it anything like his Instagram where he's a picture of a river?
Prayer hands, heart. Yeah, it's always all that. Yeah. I watched a performance of him on American TV the other day. I think he was performing Shangri-La from like his solo album, and when you perform on like a late night show, you don't address the audience in any way. You're supposed to just like look cool and like you're part of a band. Of course, it being Ed at the end, where it's supposed to be silence, he goes, thank you very much everyone, thank you very much everyone, and gives the big prayer hands. It's amazing.
Yeah,
lovely man.
He was the last live show I saw before the pandemic. I saw him do the solo album in New York,
really?
And I actually got to meet him briefly, which was, that's my only, in terms of direct contact with the band. I've gotten things signed by Tom and almost Johnny, but I missed out on Johnny. But I met Ed.
Did you go see The Smile?
I did go see The Smile, in New York City a few months ago, and it was an excellent show.
Amazing. Ed had to basically cancel like his whole EOD tour, right? I was due to see
and
him.
And he had COVID himself. It was a rough couple months.
Rough. And he's obviously just kind of never toured that record, which is a shame, I think.
I know. Yeah.
I like that.
But he's working on another now, I guess. So hopefully he'll be out playing some of those songs too.
Fingers crossed. Where did we get to?
Four. We're at number three. We're at the top three now.
Okay. Luke is very confident going four.
I feel confident we left off.
No, we did four is what I mean.
Right. Okay. Right. I got you.
I had number three as Everything in Its Right Place.
Cool.
Banger.
It's quite a banger. And that one, I think you alluded to like getting the synth sounds, and I had to do the sampling. So Johnny's main claim to fame in that song is putting Tom's vocals into a Chaos pad, which was short-lived but ever popular, and popular with Muse actually, because Bellamy has one in his guitar. XY kind of like pad controller that messes with stuff and does DJ effects, but Johnny uses it to sample Tom's voice and kind of flip it around. So I couldn't really do that live because I had to sing first and then record it, but I took samples of my voice, put it back into the pad, and then messed around with it. And then the main claim to that, I think that may be my most viewed video still, in terms of covers, the Everything in Its Right Place, but I went for the 2018 aesthetic. So again, this is like in terms of songs that have evolved in their live lineup, because they don't even play the same song the same way two tours in a row. But this is one when they brought it back in 2016 through 18, they used a much more, I'll say, Blade Runner-y or say kind of like
saturated
synth sound with a lot more fuzz to it, a lot more kind of sawtooth kind of sound. So
it's like the synthwave version of Everything in Its Right Place.
Exactly. Yeah. It's less muted and more like brash. So. Yeah. That was the version I was going for there, and was pretty happy with the way that one came out. So that was fun.
That's cool. I wonder why that's the most popular of yours I guess I don't know.
Because it's their best song, isn't it?
Well, I was wondering if it like meets an apex of like interesting to see someone recreate and their most like one of their more famous. There's like a perfect like correlation.
Yeah.
There. Yeah.
I don't know how the lords of the algorithm or how attention works or like I never know. I'm proud of the every cover I do, but I just kind of throw it out there. I'm like, well, we'll see.
We'll see.
And I probably don't know if, you know, I'm posting them at the right time or whatever, but that one caught on okay. So I was pretty happy with that.
Yeah. Excellent.
Number two is Lift, but specifically the mini disc version that I did. So that was from when they did the
excellent.
Yeah. So when they had the leak of their pre.
This means nothing to Lucas and Steve. This is just we haven't got
the
there
fact
yet.
That there's a mini disc version though is
enough. The fact that there's the mini disc version specifically actually allow me to wonderful.
Elaborate and further dig myself into this hole. The kind of promo or proto demo versions of the songs that leaked. Perhaps under not the best circumstances for the band, but then they kind of owned it and then officially released those mini disc recordings. And it's the most like to me, the true to form version of the song. They released one on the anniversary version of OK Computer. That's like a little bit more mellow. I still love that version too, but I chose to cover that version, because it had that energy, that kind of like almost arena rock thing, which Radiohead doesn't often do. But it reminded me of that kind of like the Pink Pop 1996, like, you know, just like in your face live version of the song.
That's a popular version for a lot of people, right? The Pink Pop 96 one.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You guys will probably like Lift when we get there, I think, when we do the OK Computer reissue. I think you'll respond well to that. It's Ed's quote on it. Manic Street Preachers, not a big band in the US. But Ed's quote on it is that it was Radiohead doing a design for life.
Okay.
So look forward to that. There you go.
Awesome. All right. Yeah. And then my top is there. And that one is perhaps a trick because I still have not, and people have asked, I haven't covered, like done the basement version cover of that song yet, but it came from a live performance of us there, the tribute band playing it. We played it in Boston last year. And so I put that one out and, it's a fun song to play live. I played it from both Ed's perspective, where you just get to bang the drum the whole song, and that's awesome.
Yeah.
That's a great feeling. But also the guitar tuning, the feedback, the energy of having like three drums on stage is fantastic. So that is a very fun song to cover and play live.
I can imagine that explosion in the middle is so satisfying. Yeah. So satisfying. Amazing. Cool. I'm going to post links to all of those in our show notes. And I'm sure that you're going to be all over our socials for this week as well. I mean, that kind of wraps it up. What else do you have coming up? I will obviously post links to your YouTube channel and your band and your own music and all of that stuff. What have you got coming out?
Oh, thank you. So the nearest thing happening for us is we're performing near Boston, Massachusetts in the US at the end of this month. So January 28th, we're planning.
I tell you what, Joe, this comes out in March.
Okay. All right.
So sorry.
Rewind. We're playing in Philadelphia in April, but that's by that point. It might also be Philadelphia in the US on April 1st. We're playing in Asbury, New Jersey, home of the famous Bruce Springsteen, and actually my hometown. We're performing there at the Asbury Lanes on June 10th. And otherwise, I'm just going to be doing what I do and probably more covers and tutorials and stuff coming soon to the channel.
Is there a cover you're working on at the moment?
At this very moment, I think the next one in the docket is probably another Smile song with Taka. We've been doing Smile, so maybe Free in the Knowledge, possibly.
Oh, that's maybe my favorite from that.
Right? That is a beautiful song, yeah.
The stuff you guys are working out with the delay on things like Thin Thing and stuff like that is crazy. I just cannot get my head around it.
Excellent. That's that 5/16 thing that Johnny does, which is wild.
Yes, it is. I'm going to have to take your word for it, Joe. I've got no idea what that means.
I'll make another video. But.
Well, okay, that brings us to the end of another episode. But before we do go, can I please read an email?
Mm. Yeah.
The problem with the emails is that they're written in by our listeners.
That's one of the main issues with them. God, God, I wish they were written by anybody else. I'm going to read an email from somebody. One, because it's kind of connected to what we talked about today. And two, because I'm very intrigued by this person who is known simply as GB. Don't know who it is. Don't know who it is.
Garlic bread.
Maybe, mm-hmm. maybe it is. All right.
Yeah.
Quick Q, they've put. And I think the Q stands for question. Because otherwise, it'll be added to the enormous pile of theoretical Qs that have been accumulating since the first Holy Bible episode. In regards to Adam's change of heart on favourite Radiohead album, does the giant OK Computer Sessions mini disc leak and having that as a resource to draw on while covering OK Computer affect or increase your appreciation of the album? Interesting. Although the classic rock canon has been doing the full album session recordings box set thing for a while, the OK Computer mini discs feel like they give even greater context by adding live rehearsals, dictaphone demos, build recordings, etc., especially the band's mood board / scrapbook rather than simply the sum total of studio sessions. Without access to that depth of resource, does an already somewhat abrasive album like Kid A become even harder to build a connection with? Brackets, spoiler. Personally, yes, I think it does. Would jump on the chance to hear the full Kid Amnesia sessions and fragments of different tracks coming together. Love the podcast. Long-time listener, as you might have guessed, aside from the Muse season, truly appalling band, and a big part of why I stopped listening to guitar music from about 1999 to the mid-2010s. Signed, GB. That's a bit harsh on me, I reckon. That's probably a bit harsh.
Wait, hang on. Is it Gary Barlow?
It might be Gary Barlow. It must be Gary Barlow. I can't think of anybody else it would be. No. I can't.
Thanks, Gazza.
I'm going to answer those questions very, very briefly. Yes, stuff like that does make me go, wow, it's impressive that they did all that stuff and all those hidden details are on there. And it's interesting to hear what they left off because some of the stuff they left off is just as good. But then you get into the sort of stuff of like, oh, well, that's how an album is crafted. And the idea that they're crafting something very specific is quite impressive to me. But on your second point, I do have a lot of that stuff for Kid A. The Kid Amnesia re-release, the video game, had a lot of stems and stuff. So I find Kid A to be equally as impressive in that regard. I just find it in general to be a colder album. And all of that stuff taken aside, the album's got to grab me in some kind of emotional way. Like, if there was an album that I didn't really like, but it was doing something really, really impressive, it wouldn't make me like it that much more. I'd just go, yeah, it's impressive, but it doesn't grab me. So what can you do about it? There you go. Thank you.
And yet you give me grief GB. For my Holy Bible score.
What do you mean?
Well,
did I give you grief?
You give me so much grief, Adam. You threatened to kill me.
No, yeah. I don't remember any of that. I don't remember that.
But that's nothing to do with the Holy Bible. Oh, I just hate your existence, mate. Okay. To be honest with you. Sorry. Thank you very much for listening. Our next episode is out next Monday. Does anybody know what we're doing?
Oh, is it like the grab bag of other miscellaneous Radiohead side
we're
project
We're going to be looking at Atoms for Peace, Tomorrow's Modern Boxes, Weatherhouse, and Jeunun. All wrapped up into one episode. So do come and join us for that, because that'll be an interesting, varied episode, I think. Before you do, come and let us know what you think about all of the stuff that Joe talked about. Check out his YouTube channel. It's genuinely incredible. It's very impressive. Find us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at What Is Music Pod, TikTok at What Is Music. And if you'd like to send in something a little bit longer, like Gary Barlow did, we can read it out on the show. You can email us, whatismusicpod@gmail.com. And if you like what you heard here and thought, I want more of that, please head on over to our Patreon page. You'll find extra podcast shows, bonus content, ad-free episodes of this show, the entire archive ad-free, and an incredible Discord community that is contributing to this show and, you know, directly involved in the other shows. There's also occasionally a game where we guess what song title we're spelling out of emojis that is fucking infuriating. You can head to patreon.com.
I like it.
You do like it, do you?
Yeah, I like it.
Cool. Is it always when I'm reading the URL that you're going to interrupt me? That's two episodes in a row.
All right, we'll see. Let's find out next week.
Head to patreon.com/whatismusicpod or follow the link in the show notes for up to 2 podcast episodes every single week. And if you're thinking, do you know what?
I want to give these guys some money to keep the podcast going, but certainly not on a regular basis. Go and buy some of our merchandise. whatismusicpod.redbubble.com, where we've just successfully... We've just successfully foiled someone who was trying to steal one of our designs.
Oh, Is it taken down?
It's been taken down.
Desist.
Why would you steal someone's design and leave the brand name on it? That's bizarre. Anyway,
also, why would you steal someone's design when it's that stupid?
I know. I'm going to be honest. that design did not have wide market appeal. Or if you just want to support us in other ways, you can send a little something over on ko-fi.com, which is ko-fi.com/whatismusic. That about does it. Thanks again for listening. But before you go, please, don't leave me. Hi. Don't leave me.
Leave.
Bye.
Me.
Goodbye. Don't leave me. Hi. Don't leave me dry. Ah, oh, fuck.
Didn't even get the right word.
I didn't get it right.